Each standardized component was only part of a man, condemned to work only at part of a job and live only part of a life. As the machine realm, those aspects of life subject to specialized division of labor grows, so the depersonalization and anxiety intensifies. Today, the realm of the machine has expanded to include almost everything. The factory system, with its emphasis on standardization of parts and mass production as a path toward efficiency, is applied far beyond manufacturing. In schools, for instance, the standardized curricula, trained operators, classification of product via grading are all reminiscent of the factory. The resemblance is not accidental. Schools were designed by some of the same efficiency experts who designed factories, and the dehumanization is the same as well. Here the process begins of assigning to each person more and more numbers, which eventually come to define us as mere sets of data. Meanwhile, in agriculture, the logic and methods of industry have been applied to the land itself, subjecting it to the same imperative of efficiency and, in effect, reconceiving the earth as itself a factory. The Industrial Revolution that promised to make each human a king or god also exacerbated human separation from nature. Whereas the ancient mega-machine allowed works beyond individual human capacity, the steam engine allowed works beyond human biological capacity, reinforcing the idea that human beings are not actually part of nature, or perhaps that our destiny is to rise above nature. The remaining unconquered natural domains of old age, death, social ills, and so forth would fall before the juggernaut of science, technology, and industry, just as all the other limitations had fallen already. This, the technological program, conceived its greatest conceptual impetus from the manifestly supernatural works of industrial technology. Kirkpatrick Sale foresees the grim consequences. Quote, "Imagine what happens to a culture when it becomes based on the idea of transcending limits and enshrines that as the purpose of its near-global civilization. Predictably, it will live in the grip of the technological imperative, devoted unceasingly to providing machinery to attack the possible. Imagine then what happens to a culture when it actually develops the means to transcend limits, making it possible, and therefore right, to destroy custom and community, to create new rules of employment and obligation, to magnify production and consumption, to impose new means and ways of work, and to control or ignore the central forces of nature. It would no doubt exist for quite a long time, powerful and expansionary and prideful, before it had to face up to the truth that it was founded upon an illusion, and that there are real limits in an ordered world, social and economic as well as natural, that ought not to be transgressed, limits more important than their conquest." Close quote. The machine, then, gave us both the confidence and the wherewithal to attempt the transcendence of natural limitations, to ascend, like the Babylonians, to heaven and assume the powers of a god. Prophets, poets, and Luddites aside, it is only recently that we have begun to doubt this program, and now only because it is so evidently stalling. One reason it is stalling is foretold by the Babel story, in which a babble of mutually unintelligible languages made it impossible to coordinate the tower building. In parallel, the fine division of labor that makes the entire technological project possible eventually generates such difficulty in managing that labor, so much chaos, that the effort collapses under its own weight. We see this, too, in science, where hyperspecialization renders various fields inaccessible to each other. Communication among fields becomes impossible. Each progresses towards solving its own narrowly defined problems, but systemic problems become increasingly hopeless. The immediate result of steam-driven industry was not to make each man a god, but a slave. For the worker, The transcendence of biological limitations meant the subordination of the rhythms of flesh and blood to the rhythm of the machine. Never tiring, never requiring food, sleep, or rest. Kirkpatrick Sale describes it thus. The task for the factory owner was to make sure that workers would be disciplined to serve the needs of the machines. In training human beings, Andrew Urey said, to renounce their desultory habits of work and to identify with the unvarying regularity of the complex automaton. Close quote. The factory marked, if not the start, a key quickening of the modern conception of work, something that we must discipline ourselves to do in denial of desultory biological impulses. Work became toil, of necessity repetitive and unvarying, like the machine functions it served. As it was for labor, so it was for the products. If the early cultural technologies of label and number suggested the genericness of their objects, industry attempted to realize it through its emphasis on standardization and uniformity of product. With few exceptions, natural objects are unique, variable. Industry sought the opposite, the unnatural uniformity of its products, further reinforcing the divorce between human and nature. Along with this mass-scale uniformity came the disintegration of local differences as people everywhere began to eat, wear, and use identical products and perform identical labor. We see this process culminating in the homogeneity of the early 21st century American landscape. The generic roads, housing developments, franchises, superstores, and strip malls that comprise, in Jane Holt Kaye's phrase, the landscape of the exit ramp. Finally, the standardization, homogeneity, and specialization of function that characterized the factory equally characterized the inhabitants of machine society. What began with Mumford's mega machine has never truly disappeared, only worked itself deeper. Our specializations define us and validate our existence. Lumped together as consumers or the workforce, classified statistically into categories of pollsters and social scientists, we humans have been made generic too, robbed of the individuality that once derived from a unique set of relationships to nature and kin. Industry took its conclusion to the reduction of nature that started on the psychological level with symbolic culture and was projected onto the land with agriculture. Whereas these earlier developments reduced world to object, industry turned object into commodity, from time into money, and human being into consumer. All the world, in other words, is being converted into money, the ultimate in anonymity, abstraction, and genericness. A story I take up in Chapter 4. Is there then no hope other than to undo the entire course of specialization and return to a society without division of labor? Is there no choice but to abolish all the technology that depends on it? I don't want to leave you on a note of despair, so let me offer a sneak preview of a later chapter. In fact, there is a system in which specialization leads not to the reduction of the individual, but to her fulfillment. The model for such a system is sitting in your chair. It is a society of cells that comprise a human body. The organs of such a society are growing already, and it is this organic or ecological society that will soon supplant the dying civilization of the machine. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Religion and ritual. Ritual, as we understand it today, employs symbolism, in which representations of objects stand in for real objects, and ritual enactments of events stand in for real events. However, like language and art, symbolic ritual evolved gradually from a time before separation, when symbol and object were one. Very likely, the rituals of deep antiquity were an outgrowth of animal rituals of mating, dominance, and so forth, and were not symbolic at all, at least no more symbolic than the songs of birds. Rituals only became symbolic when spirit became abstracted from physicality. That only happened when divinity became separated from nature, and that only happened when technology and culture created a separate human realm, especially when agriculture placed nature in an adversarial role. Wearing dualistic blinders, it's hard for us to imagine any ritual that was not symbolic, a ritual that is a real thing and not the representation of a story, principle, or event. So accustomed are we to asking what it means, what it symbolizes, that we can hardly conceive that the appropriate inquiry might be to ask what it is. We can hardly conceive of understanding something apart from interposing another level of interpretation between us and it. Symbolic religious ritual is in itself a mediation between two separately conceived realms, the human and the divine. In the original religion, animism, there was no such distinction. Often misunderstood as the belief that everything has spirit, animism actually holds that everything is spirit, that everything is sentient, sacred, special. Therefore, the abstraction of the particular, embodied in language and number, is, from the animistic point of view, a sacrilege, turning a continuum of unique places and moments into just so many things. Probably, even the purest animistic religions studied by anthropologists are already degraded versions of true animism, existing as they do in cultures that have already adopted representational language. We look upon the Neanderthal custom of burying their dead with artifacts as a sign of their cognitive or spiritual development, as it implies a belief in an afterlife, and therefore a concept of soul separate from body. I do not know if the Neanderthal already had a dualistic religion, but the above interpretation lays bare a deep cultural prejudice that matters of spirit are in a realm separate from the life of this world, separate from here and now. What, may we ask, is the religion of animals? Religion, which literally means that which ties back or that which reconnects us, is only necessary when there is separation. A being constantly in touch with the fullness, sumptuousness, and indeed the infinity of sheer existence would have no need for religion. We may therefore see religion as a symptom of separation. But does that not mean religion is a mistake? More than a symptom of separation, religion is also a response to it, a manifestation of the primal urge to reunite with all we have separated from. Perhaps religion originated as a calling back to an earlier time of wholeness. Let us revisit this earlier time of wholeness to see how religion might have developed. An assumption rarely questioned in paleontology is that early species of humans were in important respects inferior to modern Homo sapiens. The evidence would seem incontrovertible. Not only did all other Homo species become extinct, but their tools were much simpler, and they left little or no evidence of art, religion, and all the other creations of modern intelligence. We must be careful, however, not to project modern-day prejudices onto the physical evidence of paleontology and archaeology. We tend to interpret burial of the dead as evidence of belief in an afterlife and therefore a non-material soul, cave paintings as evidence of magical religious rituals aimed at controlling events, and technological advances as motivated by the struggle to survive. All of these interpretations may be projections of our own dualism and anxiety. Moreover, the tendency to equate the developments of language, technology, and so forth with progress or advancement in culture and cognition depends on the self-assumed superiority of our own culture. However, in light of the negative effects of language, number, tools, agriculture, and time measurement discussed above, it would behoove us to re-examine the supposed inferiority of those who refused them. Recent evidence, rigorously laid out in Stephen Oppenheimer's 2003 book, Out of Eden, has shattered the myth that modern human cognition developed in a gene-fueled European cultural explosion some 30 to 40,000 years ago. The most significant development in stone tool technology occurred some 300,000 years ago, with the development of flake tools chipped off a specially prepared stone core, a multi-stage process requiring that the final product be fixed in the maker's mind throughout. Neanderthals and their Cro-Magnon cousins had almost identical technology up until 50,000 years ago. The disappearance of European Neanderthals is something of a paleontologic enigma, especially given recent mitochondrial evidence that no interbreeding occurred between the Neanderthal and the Cro-Magnon humans that simultaneously inhabited Europe some 28,000 to 40,000 years ago. The usual survival of the fittest, scarcity-based thinking assumes that the latter either exterminated the former directly, thanks perhaps to superior weaponry, intelligence, and social organization, or simply outcompeted them for habitat. In any event, a dramatic cultural diversion separated the two species at an accelerating rate around 40,000 years ago, and apparently resulted in the Neanderthals' extinction by 28,000 years BCE. Although some exceptions have been claimed, it is generally thought that Neanderthals lacked art, trade, tools of bone, shell and antler, and burial of the dead. Neanderthal primitivism is usually taken to either one, imply that Neanderthals were insufficiently intelligent to develop the technology of modern humans, or two, as evidence of culture's cumulative nature. That is to say, Neanderthals were as intelligent as we are, but the technology simply had not time to develop. The first position is increasingly untenable, given the parallel development of Stone Age technology up until 50,000 years ago, not to mention Neanderthals' slightly larger brain size. Either way, they apparently suffered the same fate as most of the world's indigenous peoples did upon encountering a technologically more advanced culture. A third possibility is rarely discussed, that Neanderthals consciously rejected the innovations that led to our widening separation from nature. It would not be the only time such a rejection occurred. The more recent history of technology is not without examples of technology rejected or even abandoned. Perhaps the Neanderthals had the anatomical and cognitive capacity to proceed on the accelerating arc of the ascent of humanity, but simply refused to do so. Perhaps they refused the distancing, alienating technologies of semiotic language, number, art, time, and standardized stone tools, intuiting, as have shamans and religious mystics ever since, that they separate us from nature, spirit, and joy. Perhaps they recognize the idolatry implicit in representational images, the reduction implicit in symbolic language, the suffering implicit in separation of self from environment. Perhaps they thought that separation had gone far enough and knew that its continued ascent could lead to one place only. Consider the megafauna extinctions of the Northern Hemisphere. These happened remarkably recently, after the Neanderthals were gone and modern humans fully established, and are usually attributed to our superior technology and, by implication, our superior intelligence. Pause for a moment to think about this. A major ecosystem disruption is taken as a sign of superior intelligence? We assume that it is human nature to take as much as possible. Let us discard that assumption for a moment and suppose that the Neanderthals and other pre-modern humans had the intelligence but not the desire. Perhaps they had the wisdom to avoid practices that would disrupt the balance of nature. Later cultures, more distant from nature, nonetheless still understood the importance of maintaining that dwindling connection. They used religious ritual and magic to reaffirm and renew it, relying on an ancient lineage of shamans and stories going back to their original teachers, from a time when harmony with nature did not need these artificial means of reconnection. The idea finds support in certain indigenous myths and legends. Here is a particularly striking one, courtesy of Joseph Epps Brown. Quote, "The Yurok of Northern California believe that in the beginning, the world was inhabited by the Woge, or immortals, who knew how to live in harmony with the earth. The Woge departed when the humans arrived. Yet because they knew that humans did not always follow the laws of the world, they taught them how to perform ceremonies that could restore the earth's balance." Close quote. The correspondence here with the actual historical departure of Neanderthals and other human species with the coming of Homo sapiens is quite remarkable. The Woge departed when the humans arrived. In Europe, from 40,000 to 28,000 BCE, the overlap between Neanderthal and modern human was very brief. The former's retreat before the latter was almost instantaneous. Nowhere did the two coexist for very long. This story may have been the same with other human species across Asia. Perhaps the Neanderthals and the other human groups that our ancestors replaced were not lesser humans, lower on the evolutionary ladder, but actually more evolved in thought and spirit than we are. I like to speculate that they were even our teachers, exemplars of a mode of being that already 40,000 years ago we had begun to forget, but which has been carried forward to the present time, encoded in myth and ritual, preserved in fragments by lineages of shamans, Sufis, storytellers, Taoists, yogis, and mystics, and revived from time to time by artists, poets, and lovers, so that like a spore or a seed, it might blossom forth again when the age of separation has run its course. As separation accelerated through the rise of agriculture, the gap over which religion was required to tie us back widened. Humans departed further from the laws of the world, and the old ceremonies became impotent to restore balance. Slowly, nature lost its inherent divinity in human eyes and became progressively just a thing. To be sure, nature as thing was never anything more than an ideology, and an ideology that direct experience invariably contradicts when we open ourselves to it. Nevertheless, that ideology was and still is powerful enough to direct and justify a millennia-long course of domination and destruction, the subordination and conquest of nature. As described in a previous section, agriculture gradually took the gods from identity with natural forces to lordship over them, in parallel to the human abstraction of ourselves from nature. Whereas the ancient kings and pharaohs were divine, starting in Mesopotamia at around 2000 BCE, kings became mere emissaries or representatives of divinity, which was elevated to a celestial realm. The association of the divine with the celestial, which removes God from within nature to an estate above nature, is itself another consequence of agricultural and machine thinking. Ancient astronomers, concerned with the measurement of time and the making of calendars, observed regularities in the motions of the planets, impersonal cycles removed from the chaotic irregularity of nature. Which would the engineer, the fashioner and operator of a machine prefer? A higher, more perfect law, it was thought, governed the heavens. This split between the order and perfection of the skies and the messy chaos of the living earth was only resolved in the 17th century with Isaac Newton's unification of all motion under a single law, which had the effect of abstracting God still further. With divinity accorded a non-earthly status, human beings who are, after all, of this earth, lost their innate divinity to become mere servants of God. Around 2000 BCE, Mesopotamian myths began to appear of men created by gods to be their slaves. Men had become the mere servants, the gods' absolute masters. Man was no longer in any sense an incarnation of divine life, but of another nature entirely, an earthly mortal nature. And the earth itself was now clay. Matter and spirit had begun to separate. Accordingly, we have in the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic religions that originated in this region a concept of sinning against God that is entirely separate from violation of nature's order or harmony, and not only separate, but often directly opposed. Spirituality came to mean conquering the flesh, whose desires were opposed to the elevation of spirit. The parallel with technology and the ascent of humanity is clear. Civilization's technological quest to overcome nature with the order and regularity of the machine projects into religion as a program to overcome our unruly inner nature or human nature. Religious institutions thereby came to represent the precise opposite of what the original rites, myths, and teachings intended. The original purpose of religion, implied in the Yurok legend, is to bring us back to a state of harmony with the natural order, and in particular with our natural selves, our true being. Despite the relentless attempts of social institutions to co-opt religion to its purposes of control, the original intent and message of religion lives on, often buried beneath layers of dogma and interpretation. Every once in a while, reformers see through the dogma and remind us of the principles of the original religion, animism. A few examples. George Fox, quote, "Look to that of God in everyone," close quote. Halaj, "I and the Beloved are one," close quote. Jesus, quote, "I and the Father are one," close quote. The latter two were both crucified, the first merely beaten, pilloried, and imprisoned. All denied the reigning doctrine that the human and divine are separate realms. In Jesus' case, the teaching was almost immediately turned into its exact opposite. "I am God and so are you" was turned into "Jesus is God and you are not," recreating the same division and duality that Jesus taught against. In Oriental religions, the dualism between human and divine is less developed, and many teachings to the contrary remain preserved in Scripture. Taoism, in particular, emphasizes the identity of the spiritual way in the way of nature. Buddhism is rife with admonitions to the effect that Buddhas are no different from ordinary people, yet completely different, and that everything has Buddha nature. There are even Zen koans directed at deconstructing the implicit dualism in the statement, "everything has Buddha nature," as if it were a separate thing to be had. Similarly for Hinduism, the Bhagavad Gita states, "The Supreme Self, which dwells in all bodies, can never be slain. Eternal, universal, unchanging, immovable, the Self is the same forever," close quote. The more extreme separateness from the sacred embodied in Occidental religion fits into the same mindset of objectification and control that also characterizes technology. Perhaps it is no accident that modern technology, too, arose in the West. The perversion of religion tying back into its opposite has taken different forms across the globe. In the East, concepts of karma were perverted into duty, and cosmic order into a blind servitude to the temporal order of feudal society. The result in India was the caste system, which minutely prescribed the role of each individual. Similarly, the doctrine of the illusoriness of the finite self was co-opted to encourage the submergence of individual will into the social mass. In the Far East, the Tao degenerated from a principle of organic divinity immanent in nature and the universe into a justification for a rigid social hierarchy. Meanwhile, in the West, the differentiation of nature and the divine went a step further, beginning as names for aspects of nature, graduating into separate representatives of those aspects. The gods of ancient Greece and the god of the Levant eventually came to a position of capricious overlordship. They became rulers and not aspects of nature. Whereas in the older view, the god is simply a sort of cosmic bureaucrat, and the great natural laws of the universe govern all that he is and does and must do, we now have a god who himself determines what laws are to operate, who says, "Let such and such come to pass," and it comes to pass. The parallel with the mentality of technology is obvious. God was no longer at the mercy of nature. By understanding the principles of God's creation, then neither need be man. A corollary of the capricious celestial overlord in the human realm is free will. Modeled after our concept of God, we saw ourselves as separate manipulators of the rest of the world and subject to a very different set of laws than God has ordained for the beasts. We could choose to obey or not to obey, and we could manipulate the world as we saw fit, rather than merely playing a role in a pre-existing harmony. The Hebrew, Christian, and Muslim God, though not of these religions' esoteric traditions, provides a model for the ultimate separation of ourselves from the universe, the alienation of the discrete self in a world of objects. Eventually, of course, we dispensed with God altogether when science began explaining the workings of the world without appeal to an extra-natural mover. Another way to look at it, though, is that we displaced God. Through science and technology, we ourselves presumed to the functions previously ascribed to God. The director of nature, the free will that has the power to say, "Let such and such come to pass." If we don't like what is, we can change it. We can make something else come to pass. The Babelian logic of the technological program is that our power to do this is unlimited. The ascent of science described in the next chapter can be seen as the final phase in the progression of religion away from its holistic animistic roots. It is also a necessary phase, the culmination of an age-old process. Before I lay out the way of the world according to science, I would like to offer another interpretation of the incredible descent that masquerades as an ascent, whose story I have told. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
पति राघव राजा राम पति पावन सीताराम रघुपति राघव राजा राम पति पावन सीताराम
ईश्वर
तेरे नाम सबको सहमति दे भगवान रघुपति राघव राजा राम
पति पावन
सीताराम रघुपति राघव राजा राम पावन सीताराम
सीताराम सीताराम राजा राम राजा राम सीताराम सीताराम राजा राम राजा राम
Playful Universe. Eternity is in love with the productions of time. William Blake. John Zerzan has written, "We have taken a monstrously wrong turn with symbolic culture and division of labor. From a place of enchantment, understanding, and wholeness to the absence we find at the heart of the doctrine of progress. Empty and emptying, the logic of domestication, with its demand to control everything, now shows us the ruin of the civilization that ruins the rest. Assuming the inferiority of nature enables the domination of cultural systems that soon will make the very earth uninhabitable." Close quote. Zerzan's eloquent lament is correct in every detail except for one. Symbolic culture and the division of labor was not a, quote, monstrously wrong turn, but rather, as I have argued throughout this chapter, the direction we have been headed all along. And that would seem even worse, if not a bad choice that is in principle remediable. Is this long fall from enchantment, understanding, and wholeness just the way of the universe? Are we destined for ruination, desolation, and extinction? Or is this descent a phase of a larger pattern or process? Back in 1938, the historian Johann Huizinga advanced the concept of Homo ludens, the playful human, in direct contradistinction to contemporary anthropology, which, with near unanimity, ascribed early human behavior and development to a struggle for survival. Huizinga suggested that play, not struggle, was the formative element in cultural development, for it was the creative inner world of make-believe through which we rehearsed for the subsequent transformation of the external environment. He could have broadened the concept of Homo ludens beyond the human realm to include all of life, because play is by no means exclusively human, a fact obvious to anyone who has ever raised a dog or a cat. And it's not just domestic animals that exhibit playfulness, but wild ones too. hence the phrase monkeying around, I refer the reader to Tom Brown Jr.'s captivating accounts of playing with wild animals in his books Tracker and The Search. The function of play is quite difficult to explain in Darwinian terms, as it would seem to consume energy that could be directed toward maximizing survival and reproduction. Individuals genetically programmed to play would be at a competitive disadvantage against those who devote their full energy toward food gathering, mating, and so forth. Thus, when play is addressed at all, we would expect to find rather forced attempts to explain it, or rather explain it away, in terms of mating rituals, dominance, or practice of hunting or other skills. The other alternative, that life is naturally playful, leisurely, and fun, simply does not fit into our basic conceptions of what motivates animal behavior. In our own culture, play is typically conceived to be the realm of children. The Puritan streak in our culture views it as a luxury, an indulgence, which is okay to allot to children in small amounts, as long as they have finished their work, schoolwork, homework, housework, etc. On the more tolerant side of the spectrum, play is okay as long as it is educational, hence the numerous toys and games directed at young children which seek to smuggle in the alphabet, numbers, or other cognitive skills. To echo the Darwinian explanation of animal play as a means to hone hunting skills, play is good because it is practice for life. Play, purely for play's sake, is a waste of time, a view based on the purpose of life is to survive assumption that underlies modern science and economics. After all, every minute spent playing is a lost opportunity to get ahead in life. Either way, eventually we grow up and there is no more time for play. Now the grim business of real life begins. Oh, sure, maybe we can afford to play in our time off. That is, the time left remaining to us after we have met the demands of survival. But unless we are extremely wealthy, we believe the bulk of our time and energy must go toward work. Perhaps the truth is something quite different. Instead of youth being the time for play, maybe it is play that keeps us youthful. Perhaps the boundless free flow of creative expression is what keeps us physically and mentally supple as a child. When we attempt to control it, limit it, mortgage it to the acceptable and safe, then the bounds of that safety project themselves onto body and mind, subjecting both to a severely limited range of motion that hardens over time. Let us question the work-play dualism. Consider the possibility that childhood play is practice, yes, but practice for adult play, not adult work. For in fact, the same qualities that characterize childhood play apply equally to the most creative, productive activities of the adult. Childhood play is practice in the exploration of limits, the loosening of inhibitions to creativity, the creative dialogue with the environment, the reimagining of the world presented us. Play is not enslaved to a preset end, but allows the end to emerge spontaneously through the process itself. Play does not require willpower to stay focused and overcome our natural desires. It is natural desire manifest. When we play, we are willing to try things without guarantee of their eventual usefulness or value. Yet, paradoxically, it is precisely when we let go of such motivations that we produce the things of greatest use. In writing this book, for example, when I steel myself to cover certain material necessary to the book's logical framework, my words come out pedantic and uninspired. My best writing comes when I'm playing around with the ideas, and in this play, a logic and structure emerges that is far more potent than anything I could have thought up beforehand. I imagine Thomas Edison doing the same kind of thing, puttering around in his lab, trying this and that with no guarantee of success, but in the process thinking of a new idea, trying it out. I imagine Albert Einstein trying out, just for his fun and delight, ideas in physics that must have seemed crazy at first, but not caring, exploring them anyway. I don't mean to compare myself to these geniuses, only to illustrate a principle of creativity, forgetting about what has been done before, what will work, what brings secure results, and trying something else for the fun of it. Because the creativity of play is spontaneous, unbidden, and impervious to any rote formalization, we must consider that it comes from a source beyond ourselves. We are the universe's channel for play, an aspect of a universal playfulness expressed through our minds and bodies, employing our mental skills of reason and expression, but originating beyond them. We might then see the hallmarks of our humanity, language, math, art, technology, as originating in play, and indeed being new, highly developed means for the implementation of universal playfulness. The phenomenon of language is a case in point. In the toddler, words are a key element in the development of the imagination and the ability to create a world of make-believe. The same abstracting quality of language that distances us from reality also allows us to create and play with an inner reality, an ability which, honed through a period of mental play, we eventually reapply to the external world, creating novelty with physical things, just as we did before with mental word-associated images. Joseph Chilton Pierce speaks of the importance of storytelling to children who, as they listen with rapt attention, flesh out the stories with sequences of associated images so vivid that it is as if the experience were their own. This capacity developed in childhood can turn into the envisioning in adulthood of what might be. To envision what might be is fundamental both to play, let's pretend I'm a bear, as well as to creativity, which, if authentic, requires the imagining of a possibility that did not exist before. In modern times, when prefabricated images accompany our stories in the form of storybooks and television, the image-forming capacity never gets a chance to fully develop, and we are rendered incapable of conceiving anything other than the life that is presented to us. I propose, then, that language originated not to coordinate hunting, tool manufacture, or for any other survival purposes, nor, as John Zerzan and the linguist E.H. Sturtevant imply, for purposes of deception. Representational language arose as a form of play, a game of associating sounds to objects and actions. That is why primitive cultures recognized the relative unreality and unimportance of words as compared to sounds, voice, song, and silence, that underneath the conventional and contingent names of people and things lay a mystical true name that, as I described in discussing the lingua adamica, was not a representation, but rather an aspect of the thing itself. Just as a child at play knows that the rag on a stick is not really a baby, yet makes it so for the purpose of a game, so also did the original users of language playfully abstract words from things for the purpose of creativity, storytelling, and make-believe, in precise parallel to the cognitive function of language in a toddler. This explains the apparent paradox that even though words are on the one hand symbols, they are also endowed with real generative power. As Joseph Epps Brown puts it, language has creative force. Words are not merely symbols that point to things. They call forth the reality and power of the being mentioned. Modern thinking understands the symbolic meaning of words to be separate from their base reality, as just objects, mere combinations of sound waves or shapes on a page, not so surprisingly, really, when the things they refer to are equally mere objects of the Cartesian universe. Nonetheless, the knowledge that words are not just representational but creative too can be found in the magical and religious traditions of our own culture. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Here in the Bible, the Word is identified as the wellspring of creativity, the Godhead. Is there then a nascent separation implicit in the very existence of a physical universe? Could we see cosmic processes also as a manifestation of play? Another apparent paradox lies in the sacredness ascribed to language, which made profanity impossible in native languages, the reverence and awe attached to the names of people, animals, and places. How is sacredness, reverence, and awe compatible with play? It seems rather deadly serious. The paradox is resolved when we realize that play is serious. Our culture assumes play to be puerile or frivolous, undeserving of the attention of serious adult matters. Yet when we observe children at play, we find in them the whole range of human emotions and attachments. Laughter, yes, but solemnity too, and passion. Children, at least, take their play very seriously. The forms of recreation that masquerade these days as adult play are but pale imitations of it, sops to the spirit. They are not creative but dissipative. They don't engage us more fully in life, but rather in the guise of entertainment, remove us from life. Whether sports cars, sailboats, or video games, we don't genuinely believe in our toys. If we are able to relearn from our children how to play, then we must not limit ourselves to the frivolous and puerile. We can, like them, have occasion to play very solemnly, with great dedication and commitment, with laughter or with tears. In short, we can play our way through the full cornucopia of life's experiences. If language, technology, and the other elements of separation originated as play, then how did they become something else? In a sense, they never did. We are still at play, but immersed neck deep in a game gone very, very wrong, a game from which we are unable to extricate ourselves. After all, the separation from nature, spirit, self, and the other that I write about in this book is not real. It, too, is a play. A dance of energy and information. Our present loss of all the characteristics of play, spontaneity, fearlessness, spirit of exploration, creativity, willingness to test limits, non-attachment to results, is itself part of a larger game of individuation. In the current age, as the dance of separation becomes increasingly intolerable, as the crises mount throughout the world, we are beginning to realize that the time has come to stop playing this game and begin another one. The game of let's pretend we are discrete, isolated beings in an objective universe with all that entails has served its purpose. Another way to look at it is that we never stop playing, but we have forgotten that we are playing. Every once in a while, we run into people who are still firmly embedded in modern technological society, yet who have cast off its hurried, anxious, alienated mindsets and adopted a more easygoing, playful attitude toward life. Often this happens after a major illness or other personal calamity reveals the vacuity of former ambitions and preoccupations. They say, "I stopped taking life so seriously," or "I came back to what's really important." Yet despite not taking it so seriously, they are not detached from life. They are not passionless or indifferent, but if anything, more involved and more fully engaged in the moment, because it is precisely the anxiety of modern life that removes us from the moment, that makes us feel we cannot afford to be here now or to fully engage in whatever we are doing. Another thing these people say is, "I stopped taking myself so seriously." Pointing toward the original source of modern ugliness, suffering, and anxiety in our misconception of self. The forms and structures of our society conspire to instill a false conception of ourselves, to hide from us who we truly are, but we still have the power to disbelieve what we are told and to reclaim our birthright of play. Whereas primitive societies naturally fostered adults secure enough and connected enough to live playfully, our own holds us hostage through subtle, omnipresent threats to our survival. Survival anxiety is what the phrase "cannot afford to" encodes. The sense of being threatened is so subtle and so deeply woven into the fabric of our existence that we are rarely aware of it, like the threat of thunder on a cloudless, humid summer afternoon. It begins in early childhood when, through punishment, shaming, and conditional approval, our parents wield the greatest threat of all over our heads, indeed the archetypal threat, which is abandonment by the parent. Eventually, we internalize it as an unremitting sense of disquiet that renders us unable to fully concentrate or fully relax. The two are closely related. In the absence of powerful stimuli such as drugs, movies, and other thrills. Despite my acute awareness of the vast panorama of atrocity and suffering that comprises a history of humanity's alienation, I do not say that it was all a mistake. As I have argued, the extreme of separation that we have explored in recent centuries was written into the future long ago. But more than a neutral inevitability, perhaps the current condition of alienation is necessary for our future development, a possibility I will explore in a later chapter. In any event, it is time for the present game of let's pretend to end. I say this not as an exhortation, but as a simple statement of fact. Just as the age of separation was inevitable from the inception of agriculture or even before, its ending is equally inevitable. It is inevitable because it is untenable, unsustainable, or to be more precise, sustainable only at a higher and higher price. Our reunion with the other, in the form of nature, other people, and lost parts of ourselves, will happen when the price of separateness becomes intolerable. I say this as certainly as I can say to an alcoholic, your addiction will not last forever. The addiction generates its own demise. As the gathering crises of the world visit themselves personally upon more and more of us, as it becomes more difficult to insulate ourselves from their effects, no matter how wealthy we are, no matter how skillful we are in exercising control over the world, we are collectively hitting bottom. The effect on our society will be similar to the effect on the individual of a close brush with death. When recovering addicts share stories of incredible lost opportunities, torn families, ruined lives, and the destruction left in their wake, their regret is tempered by the knowledge that they have emerged somehow wiser. They tell of a breakthrough to self-forgiveness, which is nothing less than the knowledge that, given who they were, that they could have done no other than what they did. This parallels the inevitability I speak of. The horrifying course of human history was built into who we were, and through its passage, we are becoming something different and greater. Collectively and as individuals, we are being born into a new self. The good news is that this will happen no matter what, as inexorably as a baby is born when gestation is complete. The bad news is that we nonetheless have the power to delay our birthing indefinitely, even to the point where both mother and child must perish. The purpose of my writing is simply to tell everyone not to resist the inevitable. The gig is up, the game is over. It's time to wake up and play something else. And that was the conclusion of Chapter 2, The Origins of Separation, from The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises that is Birthing the Transition, by Charles Eisenstein. I'll continue next week with more reading, but if you can't wait, you can go and download it right away, and as well as find out more about Eisenstein and his other works at ascentofhumanity.com. And you can download a copy of this program in MP3, as well as all previous episodes, at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you.